Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We have a challenging environment, to say the least. I think it's fair to say arguably more challenging than at any time in recent memory. Adversaries of our country are on the march. I think they sense a weakness on the part of our own government that can be exploited, and they are probing inexorably worldwide. One of the places in which that probing is taking place, and unfortunately there's reason to believe our enemies are particularly emboldened, is in the Middle East. And there we've seen the Biden administration pursuing relations with the Iranian government. They have been weakening our relations with, among others, Israel and the Gulf states. And we are, I think, seeing vacuums of power being filled there by, notably, the Chinese communists and the Russians. And all of this argues for taking counsel from one of our duty experts on that region. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. He served his government of Israel in the United States as its counselor on congressional affairs with the rank of ambassador for many years. And he has been, ever since, a very prominent and thoughtful commentator on what is going on in the region and how it relates to but not just the vital interest of his state, of Israel, but also of the United States as well. Mr. Ambassador, it's always good to have a chance to catch up with you. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the upcoming visit of President Biden to the region. He will be spending some time in Israel. We're told he's going to be spending time with the Palestinians as well, and visiting elsewhere in the Gulf in the course of his travels. What is the current reading of this visit and its prospects?
Well, my own hope is that the president will leverage the visit in order to stop the erosion of the U.S. posture of deterrence in the Middle East and throughout the globe, and will use it to enhance the U.S. posture of deterrence. He's going to be in Saudi Arabia meeting with other Arab Sunni Gulf leaders who are extremely, extremely disappointed with the performance of the current administration, which has embraced their mortal enemy, the Ayatollahs of Iran. And at the same time, this administration has put the pressure on the traditionally pro-American Arab Sunni entities in the Persian Gulf, most notably Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Tony Blinken, who literally, in my mind, sets President Biden's national security and foreign policy, Secretary Blinken is on record stating publicly that he is going to put the Saudis on notice. You don't say such thing as a Secretary of State when it comes to your traditional ally, but certainly it has reflected detachment from the Middle East. And here comes the president, who initially wanted to excommunicate Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, put the Saudis on notice, and is literally coming to Saudi Arabia asking, begging them to increase the oil exports in order to bring the price of oil down. That is not something which befits a leader of the free world. When it comes to Israel, and the talk so far is that there'll be a visit to the Palestinian Authority, supposedly a visit to East Jerusalem without being accompanied by representatives of the sovereign country of Israel. If indeed the visit will take in such a place, it's going to intensify Palestinian radicalism. It's going to have a very bad impact on the stability of the region, because this would be an invitation to further Palestinian terrorism. And the whole idea of redividing Jerusalem, of establishing an American consulate in Jerusalem, which would in fact be an American embassy to the Palestinian Authority, first and foremost would violate the 1995 American Jerusalem Embassy Act, which is an American law. And the law specifies that Jerusalem is united and exclusive capital of Israel. Reversing such a policy would portray the U.S. as if it acts under Arab threats, under Arab pressure. And this, again, does not bode well for America's posture of deterrence. And last and not least, maybe most importantly, the whole idea of putting pressure on Israel, as is the intent of Secretary Blinken, to retreat from the mountain ridges of Judea and Samaria, that in my mind reflects complete misunderstanding of America's best interest in the region. Israel on the mountain ridges secures the survival of the pro-American Hashemite regime in Jordan, and therefore, in fact, enhances the national security of Jordan's neighbors from the south, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. And at the same time, should there be a Palestinian state on the same mountains of Judea and Samaria of the West Bank, this would be the end of the pro-American Hashemite regime, which would cause an anti-American avalanche. Hopefully, the visit to the Middle East will introduce to the president the real Middle East, rather than the overly simplistic Middle East as is reflected by the current policy.
Well, you've covered an awful lot of ground there, Mr. Ambassador, and I want to sort of see what we can do to drill down on several different pieces of it. I guess the overall observation is that President Biden is coming into this region in a weakened state and as a supplicant, having alienated our friends and seeking now further, it seems, to undermine them. And it's exceedingly difficult to see any positive good coming out of all of that, especially as it relates, as you say, to the strategic environment, both for Israel itself and its immediate neighbors, and then those further down in the Gulf who are all now extremely anxious. And you didn't touch on Iran. We're going to talk a little bit more about that on the other side of a short break. But I do want to just say, you have enumerated a bill of particulars of problems and misunderstandings that is deeply alarming, and I think is likely to make this a very fraught trip for the President of the United States indeed. We're going to talk more about Iran and other aspects of this with Ambassador Ettinger on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Monday, Communist China ratcheted up yet again its territorial claims to the waters, airspace, and resources of the Western Pacific. Beijing declared that it has, quote, sovereignty, sovereign rights, and jurisdiction over the Taiwan Strait, unquote, the 90-mile-wide stretch that separates Taiwan's island from the Chinese mainland. The United States and Taiwanese government have properly rejected this assertion, affirming that the strait is instead an international waterway and declaring an intention to continue to exercise freedom of navigation there. Unfortunately, in the Taiwan Strait, as elsewhere, the Chinese Communist Party is inexorably creating facts on the ground, or at sea, that will enable the People's Liberation Army not just to enforce its requirements for permission to transit or otherwise utilize contested areas. They are preparing for war. We must, therefore, be about deterring and, if necessary, defeating the future aggression being telegraphed. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We're visiting with Ambassador Joram Edinger, a longtime ambassador and diplomatic figure in his native state of Israel, now the author of the Edinger Report and a great resource to this program. We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him. Mr. Ambassador, let me just ask you, as the region is trying to make sense of what the Biden team is up to, is it fair to say that the president has seemingly decided, and his subordinates obviously, to embrace America's enemies at the expense of its friends? And if that's correct, is it likely that our friends are going to be less likely to be friendly, especially in the course of his visits there, and our enemies be more emboldened? The consensus being presumably that if it's better to be an enemy of the United States than an ally, you're likely to have more enemies, no?
Well, America's friends, whether you're talking about the Sunni Arab countries of the Persian Gulf or Egypt or Jordan or Israel, America's friends want a deterring America. They don't want an America which appeases and retreats and concedes and shares common agenda with the United Nation. America's friends want America, which understands that retaining the independence of unilateral national security action is the guiding line. At this stage, ever since Secretary Blinken assumed power, it's not the independent unilateral America, it's the highly, highly dependent, multilateral, cosmopolitan America, which seeks common denominator with the UN and with the European. The only way to achieve common denominator with the UN and the Europeans is to undermine America's own interests. And America's own interests are consistent with the minimization of global insanity. At this stage, with the decline or erosion of America's posture of deterrence, this is a cause for jubilation in Russia and China and Tehran and North Korea and Venezuela and Cuba and the headquarters of Taliban and Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, and certainly a cause for deep, deep concern among America's traditional friends in the Middle East. I would even suggest that a major reason behind the recent dramatic enhancement of military and commercial cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia, Israel, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain and Oman has to do with the realization of the Sunni Arab regimes that they are not very, very certain about the credibility of the U.S. And at the same time, they consider Israel to be highly credible in face of mutual threat, which is the regime of the Ayatollahs of Iran.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that regime. The Prime Minister of Israel has, as I understand it, now reaffirmed his concern that Iran is very close to having the nuclear capabilities that it's long sought. This would suggest that the time for further temporizing and hoping against hope that that's not going to happen, or that a deal of some kind is going to spare us a nuclear-armed Iran, is essentially at an end. Do you see it that way, Ambassador Edinger? And if so, do you anticipate that we're really at the point where the only option left now is military action to prevent the Iranians from not only gaining access to these weapons, but perhaps using them as well?
Well, the challenge for the U.S. policymakers, in my mind, is to be reconnected with Middle East reality, with Iranian reality. If you go back to 1978-79, when President Carter courted Ayatollah Khomeini and was basically taken for a long ride by Ayatollah Khomeini, who convinced President Carter and his own team that the Ayatollahs are not going to be concerned about external matters, only domestic matters. And President Carter was convinced, as he put it in his own words, that Ayatollah Khomeini was going to be preoccupied with tractors, not with tanks. As a result, it was the U.S. that paved the road for the Ayatollah's takeover of Iran. It was the U.S. that basically prevented a military opposition to the Ayatollahs. And as expected, terrorists bite the hand that feeds them. And the next thing that we saw was the Ayatollahs taking over the American embassy, holding more than 50 Americans hostage for 444 days. The same policy also underlined the attitude of President Obama and Vice President Biden when they came up with the 2015 JCPOA, under the assumption that the Ayatollahs can be enticed into peaceful coexistence, into democracy, into the departure from their fanatic religious goal of bringing the West and the Sunni Arabs to submission. And as a result, they showered, President Obama and Vice President Biden, they showered the Iranians with some $150 billion, most of which has been invested in bolstering the anti-American machine of terrorism and subversion and civil wars and drug trafficking and collaboration with every single anti-American regime in Latin America, the major drug cartels of Mexico, Colombia, and Bolivia, and every single Latin American terror organization. At this stage, it's time for the administration to examine their track record, which has been totally shattered by the track record of the Ayatollahs from 79 until today, and ask themselves whether it is advisable from the American point of view to persist with the diplomatic option rather than resort to the option of regime change and military. When you observe the track record of the Ayatollahs, you cannot but conclude that you are not a good, that they are not a good faith negotiators, that they, the Ayatollahs, are rogue regime, and as such, they cannot be approached as if they are good faith. In fact, they are ill faith negotiators, and it's time to revive the option of military and regime change, which, by the way, could revive also, could bolster America's posture of deterrence.
We have to leave it at that, Mr. Ambassador. Very important message and very timely, needless to say. We'll be consulting with you further as this trip approaches. In the meantime, thank you very much for your efforts today. We appreciate them greatly. Next up, Elaine Donnelly on the woke military. Is this any time to be doing that kind of harm to the only armed forces we have? That and more straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We have, of course, a challenge in our country that is of a very different character than the one that we normally are focused on. I think it's fair to say it is a societal transformational challenge, and it's being managed or engineered these days by the Biden administration under the rubric of diversity, equity, and inclusion. The sort of focus of its efforts at the moment is the celebration of Pride Month in the spirit of demonstrating just how committed it is to the, well, fundamental transformation of America, including our societal norms and conduct that is considered to be acceptable, particularly in the uniformed services of the United States military. And a woman who has devoted much of her professional life to helping speak for and advocate on behalf of those in uniform who, by and large, are not able to speak for themselves when it comes to matters involving policy that pertains on the sort of culture of the United States military, is our next guest. Her name is Elaine Donnelly, a personal hero of mine. She is the founder of the Center for Military Readiness. She has served on both Defense Department and presidential commissions over the years, advocating on behalf of common sense policies for our armed forces and respect for their traditional values and cultural norms, all of which are now under frontal assault, I think it's fair to say, by the Biden administration. Elaine Donnelly, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have you with us, even though altogether frustrating to hear from you as to what is being done to the only military we have at a time when we're more and more likely to need it to be in fighting trim than ever.
Yes, thank you so much, Frank. It's good to talk with you. This is June. It is Pride Month. The President of the United States, Joe Biden, issued a proclamation, and the title of it was A Proclamation on Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, and Intersex Pride Month for 2022. I'm not comfortable with that title, by the way. You could add an E to the LGBTQ plus list. You could include exhibitionism, because that seems to be the trend right now, exhibitionism that is occurring not just in the civilian world, but in the military as well. Recently, it was reported that Ramstein Air Force Base had a drag queen story hour scheduled for the dependents of military personnel. Now, mind you, parents don't always have a choice about education of their kids. The Department of Defense runs the largest school system in the world. So at Ramstein, when they invited in a drag queen to read a book called, let's see, how does it go? The hips on the drag queen go swish, swish, swish. And there's a video out there. You can see this. There's been several versions of it. Now, imagine if you're an Air Force mom or dad and your children are in the school system or they're going to the library. They have no choice in Ramstein Air Force Base. And they're confronted with this sort of thing. Well, you don't have a choice. And if you object, well, then you start reconsidering whether you belong in the military at all. But this administration doesn't care, because I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the beginning. It's not the most objectionable thing, because the trend now is to extend medical procedures to children, the puberty blockers, even surgeries, preteen kids, without parents' knowledge sometimes or consent. If we say that doctors in the military, doctors and nurses, have to participate in these kinds of things, we're going to see an exodus of people perhaps that we haven't seen before.
Well, and that's really the point, as far as I'm concerned, Elaine, is that we are looking at a more concerted, more comprehensive effort, it appears, to essentially purge from the military warriors whose commitments to sort of traditional military values, and for that matter, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is, as Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin has pointed out on this program in the past, you know, a place where you see enshrined the best in American values, and they're the standards against which the military has historically been judged. And to see what's being done here, to those serving themselves, whether it's the critical race theory business or whether it's this social engineering agenda, to say nothing of what you've described, Elaine, in terms of what's happening now to their dependents, it's got to be unbelievably demoralizing to the kind of people that we want in uniform. And I assume creating, as you've suggested, an exodus from the ranks. Are we also seeing difficulties replacing such personnel?
Yes, I think so. I think the size of the problem has not really been reported extensively. There has been a lot of reporting about people who are resisting for personal reasons, not en masse. Most of the military people are vaccinated against COVID. But there are some who have religious objections and personal objections, health reasons. And many of them are just being systematically removed from the military by the hundreds, it looks like. And many of these are sterling personnel, among the best that we have, and yet they're being forced out en masse in a way that shows an extreme ideology. When we talk about extremism in the military, we should talk about the extreme policies of the leadership of the military, taking the transgender agenda all the way where it's going to go, as it already is in the civilian world. Should we have male participants in women's athletics at the service academies? This is a problem we haven't seen yet, but I'll say it here first. We're going to see it in the next couple of years. What about privacy for people who don't want to share conditions of little or no privacy with persons of the opposite sex? How is that going to affect morale, especially among women? Sexual misconduct numbers, we were promised back when Barack Obama repealed the law regarding gays in the military. Oh, everything's going to be great. Transgenderism will not be an issue. That was a lie. They knew it was a lie, but they said it anyway, and Congress bought it, unfortunately. They also said that, oh, this will reduce the problems with sexual assault and harassment. Well, guess what? The numbers keep going up and up and up year after year, including male-on-male assaults. We don't know the reasons why, because these cases are not examined from the standpoint of, have the policymakers made a mistake? It's not about the people involved. It's about the policymakers. And right now, the Biden administration is fully extreme, fully on board. They will stop at nothing. And we got two more weeks in Pride Month. We've got two more years of this administration. How far it will go will be up to, I hope, a new Congress coming in, and perhaps the next president needs to restore sound values in the armed forces before it's too late.
Yeah. Elaine, I guess that's really the crux of the matter. Is there going to be enough left of our armed forces to work with, in those circumstances? We've got a problem that is corrosive in the extreme. And, you know, whatever one thinks about, homosexuals and for that matter, transsexual agendas and the like, the question is what is being done here consistent with good order and discipline of the United States Armed Forces and effectiveness on the battlefield? Is it going to be conducive to victory in future conflicts, or is it absolutely inimical to everything that we know victory requires?
Historically, the military has had those UCMJ rules of personal conduct. They've applied 24/7 on base, off base, a universal kind of thing. A couple of years ago, even during the Trump administration, Navy officials said, well, you can be whatever you want to be after hours. You can cross dress, in other words, if you feel like it, if it's a form of sexual expression. You may recall, too, in 2018, there was a drag queen performance on the carrier USS Ronald Reagan. And it was featured with full pictures and everything in Navy Times. This was during the Trump administration. And several of us went to the administration, said, are you going to allow this? As far as I know, nothing was done to stop it. And it could be going on today. We really have no way of knowing. So when a whistleblower comes forward to talk about how standards are being affected by gender quotas, which you mentioned earlier, it's really hard to get to the root of it and find out. We know the Army Combat Fitness Test has been compromised because women were not succeeding at the same rates as men. They were failing. So now they have different...
Elaine. We are out of time to get into that, unfortunately, but I think you've laid the predicate for a much more comprehensive review of what's going on here. Thank you for the great work you do at the Center for Military Readiness and for joining us from time to time with updates about what we're doing to the only military we have. God help us. We need it in the best shape we can possibly manage. Keep up the great work. We'll be right back with more straight ahead. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On Monday, Communist China ratcheted up yet again its territorial claims to the waters, airspace, and resources of the Western Pacific. Beijing declared that it has, quote, sovereignty, sovereign rights, and jurisdiction over the Taiwan Strait, unquote, the 90-mile-wide stretch that separates Taiwan's island from the Chinese mainland. The United States and Taiwanese government have properly rejected this assertion, affirming that the strait is instead an international waterway and declaring an intention to continue to exercise freedom of navigation there. Unfortunately, in the Taiwan Strait, as elsewhere, the Chinese Communist Party is inexorably creating facts on the ground, or at sea, that will enable the People's Liberation Army not just to enforce its requirements for permission to transit or otherwise utilize contested areas. They are preparing for war. We must, therefore, be about deterring and, if necessary, defeating the future aggression being telegraphed. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined by John Mills, one of our duty experts on a whole host of issues. Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China. He is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, and one of the people who, based both on his experience in the special operations of the United States Army, and as a civilian in the office of the Secretary of Defense, among other places, has equipped him to talk thoughtfully about a whole host of issues, but most especially about the challenges that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party. And we're anxious to catch up with John at a time when it seems as though the Chinese are feeling their oats, shall we say, becoming more aggressive, certainly at the rhetorical level, and arguably as a precursor to other kinds of more aggressive behavior as well. John Mills, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Always an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Well, let me start by just asking you to sort of capture, if you could, John, these various conversations, shall we say, that the United States and China have been having in recent days at very senior levels, and the sort of takeaway in terms of what the Chinese are saying in the course of these conversations, as well as their likely perception of the kind of response they're getting from their American interlocutors.
Thank you, Frank. Well, essentially what we saw over the weekend, last weekend, in the Shangri-La dialogues was essentially a modern version of the 1938 Munich conference, the infamous scene where Chamberlain gets out of his plane and waves a document. I've got an agreement from the German leader. It's right here. And the infamous, it's peace in our times. And a year later, the world collapsed into Armageddon. So it is what we saw was the Biden team, this time led by Austin and senior staff officers from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and I've been involved in a number of these kinds of venues. They were totally outmatched, overwhelmed. They were Blinkenized, like how Blinken was treated in Alaska. And it's sad, it's shameful. They don't know which way is up. They think they're being sophisticated, but they have no clarity or resolve. They don't even know or want or care about America. So how can you assert an American agenda when they don't care about America? And the Chinese know this. And then again, they went there to role play act, and they got roughed up pretty bad. And Chinese harangued them, just treated them pretty bad. And now we have the Chinese announcing essentially the Taiwan Straits, just like they did in the South China Seas, the air defense identification zone. Now the Straits are part of that, meaning You enter those, you have to call out on the radio frequency and essentially ask for permission. Now, we're blowing that off in the South China Seas, but it's a huge incremental step.
Mm-hmm. John, let me just come back to that in a moment. But staying with these meetings, in addition to Wei Fengjie, the defense minister of China, excoriating Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, we had a top diplomat doing a similar number on Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor to the President, Yang Jiechi is his name. What you're saying, I guess, is that as in the 1938 conference, what the West, in this case the United States, is conveying is a lack of resolve, a degree of sort of whistling past the graveyard, one might say, trying to pretend that what the Chinese are saying and threatening to do is really not operative. Tony Blinken, you mentioned the Secretary of State, of course, not so long ago, was laying out a major foreign policy address about China, in which he was talking about it as though it were, you know, talk about peace in our time, just a question of, you know, competing and cooperating with these guys. Knowing the Chinese as you do, John, you're a serious student of these guys, and you've gone up against them and their ilk in the past. How are they perceiving this? Is it anything other than further emboldening them to believe that they will be able to have their way, not just with Taiwan and perhaps others in the region, but us as well?
Well, I saw a recent movie, kind of a perhaps a historical revisionist view of the 38 Munich conference. And it, in many ways, it portrayed Chamberlain as a hero who bought time, bought a year. Well, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I'm not sure that's the way I look at it. So I think many, you know, so they're slapping him. Well, boy, Chamberlain, you know, he did a great job saving us. No, he didn't. He oversaw a government that was feckless, ineffective, and gave away Czechoslovakia without asking the Czechoslovakians first. So I don't consider that heroic or good to the cause of freedom. We're seeing very similar things here. Blinken, Jake Sullivan. I mean, come on, Jake Sullivan. They don't take Jake Sullivan seriously. One of the centerpieces of Spygate, who you know, led the spying against Trump, and then led part of the coup to overthrow him during his first term. Come on, the Chinese know what they're dealing with. They're lightweights. They're lightweights that don't even know what America is. And this is where we have to deal with this over and over again. This administration does not believe in America or American citizens. They are globalists first. And that's not just a glib, moniker. It has depth and meaning, because that's the problem with this administration. They don't care about the average American citizen.
Yeah, this is a deeply searing indictment, I think, and unfortunately, I believe you're absolutely right about it. John Mills, we have to take a short break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk more about this business of carving up this Taiwan Strait and other areas of the Western Pacific and what that portends as well. That and more right after this. Welcome back. John Mills is in the house virtually, our duty expert on many things of interest to us here at Securing America, but particularly the China portfolio. John, of course, has a distinguished background as a military officer in the United States Army and as a civilian official in successive administrations, both the Defense Department, the National Security Council, and elsewhere. And John, you talked a moment ago about this declaration by the Chinese Communist Party that the Taiwan Strait is an internal lake, if you will, for them, that if you want to come through it, you have to have their permission, and that it is, in fact, not international waters. The U.S. and the Taiwanese have both responded saying, well, no, this is still international waters. We're going to continue to do freedom of information operations and the like there. But you pointed out that this bears an uncanny resemblance to what the Chinese have done elsewhere in the region, specifically in the South China Sea. There, they have put into place these bastion fortresses, really, with which to enforce their directions that people need their permission to transit or otherwise utilize the water and airspace of the South China Sea. For the moment, the Chinese seem to have let it go at that. But is your concern that they can at will begin enforcing these restrictions and put us in a difficult spot, having no enduring capability to push back?
Well, you know, we must remember Americans have horrible memories, and if it happened more than 30 seconds ago, it means nothing to them, and we got to get better about that as Americans. But in 2014, the Obama administration was very, very of mixed minds and was serving many masters. And you know what it said in the Bible, you can only serve one master. So they wanted this rapprochement with China in 2014, but which simultaneously and curiously is the same time, if you read Peter Schweitzer's book, Hunter and Joe kind of went hot on, solidifying a financial connection with China. So you can't have it all ways here. On one hand, Hunter and Joe are cutting deals. On the other hand, the administration is upset over island building, but they're not doing anything about it. But then the Chinese breach Office of Personal Management and take 25 million files and identify anybody who's ever had a security clearance and anybody they've ever talked to. And so you can't have it all these ways, Obama, Biden. You must be clear and straightforward and advance American interests, not globalist interests. So they're upset. They're very emotional in many ways, in many directions. That is not enduring historic leadership. And so the fiasco of dealing with China in 2014 in the initial phase of island building, and then that announcement of the air defense identification zone. Now I'll call balls and strikes fairly. The Obama, Biden, Trump have all been consistent about challenging that, those zones. And we will go where we want to in freedom of navigation, both in the air, on the surface of the ocean and below the ocean. We will do that. And we've been consistent. But now the Chinese have geographically identified the straits. Same thing. Okay, this is incrementalism. They are chipping away at our the international order. I'm not crazy about using that term, but the American ability to go where we want to go when we want to go there. And any country, because these are international waters.
And it's not just at the rhetorical level. I guess what I'm saying is that this is increasingly backed up by the capability to actually enforce what they're saying will be the arrangements going forward. And if we don't have a persistent presence in those areas that enables us to push back on them, not just episodically, but consistently. I fear that at some point, you know, we will find ourselves at the wrong end of efforts to restrict our behavior and support of our allies. Speaking of our allies, one of the interesting developments at the Shangri-La dialogue, where that conversation took place between Defense Secretary Austin and his Chinese counterpart, John, was a statement by Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine, in which he basically called out the West and said, look, the lesson of Ukraine is protect Taiwan now, defend it now, not after it has actually been, you know, subjected to some kind of assault, whether it's a blockade or whether it's a an invasion by the Chinese Communist Party. Not news to you. You've been calling for just that behavior for some time, John, but isn't it time to be about getting those kinds of defensive capabilities in place to enable the Taiwanese to minimize the implications of the appetite, shall we say, of the Chinese for action against them?
Yeah, the American government has been inconsistent on its application of the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act and arms sales of a defensive nature. Remember, arms sales actually fall under State Department. State Department leads when you talk foreign, everybody assumes and presumes that's Department of Defense. No, it's actually State Department. And they've been very jerky and inconsistent. Secretary Pompeo and others did a wonderful job of making sure that we were more consistent. Now, there's been two recent, essentially pocket.
John, we are out of time. I've got to let you go, but this is a subject to which we will return in the very near future. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and for your great work at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and elsewhere. Keep it up. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to join us in doing just that. Check us out at securingamerica.tv. And then, as always, go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.